This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte is a city of trees, and that is not by accident. It is the result of careful planning by people years ago, along with the efforts of those who came after. But our tree canopy faces many challenges. Although we live in what is said to be one of the best urban forests in the country, at the height of pre-recession development, we were losing the equivalent of a football field of trees per week to bulldozers. And now, our tree canopy is aging. Many of our stateliest trees are old and nearing the end of their life cycles. That means our tree canopy is in need of an infusion of planting and restoration. Dave Cable is one of the people working on that. He is executive director of Trees Charlotte, which was founded just 4 years ago as a public-private collaboration to help the city expand its tree canopy to 50% by 2050. He joins us in our studio right now. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike, for having me.
I hear rumors that the inaugural Charlotte Arbor Week is looming large.
It is.
March 12th. What is Charlotte Arbor Week all about?
Well,
trees.
It's about planting a lot of trees. So Arbor Day was established back in 1867, 1872. And we celebrated here in North Carolina on the first Friday following March 15th.
Okay.
Of each year. And National Arbor Day is the last Friday in April.
But this is the inaugural week.
This is the week. So we have traditionally, over the last 3 or 4 years, planted trees at schools on Arbor Day. And this year we decided to use the Arbor Day celebration and expand it to a week to heighten people's awareness of the canopy and the work that's being done across Charlotte to expand the canopy.
Because we live in this urban forest, do you think we can't see the forest for the trees? I mean, seriously, that's a flippant question, but I mean, do we take it for granted?
We do. You fly into Charlotte, you see this beautiful canopy, you understand why we're known as the city in the forest. But when we're in the middle of it, we don't realize that our canopy is really challenged. I mean, we're losing trees at an alarming rate because they're aging out.
Right.
The canopy's under a lot of pressure. We're losing trees to development, certainly. And the canopy is not evenly spread across the community. So there's an issue of tree equity where some of us enjoy trees on a daily basis in our lives, and others really have very few trees.
This term urban forest might be new to people who have not heard previous discussions on this or other programs about what that is. So exactly what constitutes an urban forest? And I ask because I grew up in the D.C. suburbs of Virginia. And when you look down from an airplane on those suburbs, even now, you see lots of trees. But I never thought of myself. And we had a big woods behind our house in Alexandria, which is a city. I didn't think of myself living in a forest. So what is an urban forest?
Well, an urban forest is really it deals with this connection point of trees and people. When we talk about urban forestry, we're talking about trees and people and that close connection and the benefits of those trees to the urban environment as compared to production forestry down in South Carolina where there are a lot of pines grown. Mm-hmm. That isn't really about people. It is ultimately because of the products that are produced. But urban forestry and our urban forest really relates directly to that intersection and those incredible benefits that trees provide to people in the urban setting.
Okay. And why or how, I guess, did we get this designation of having one of the best urban forests in the country? I mean, how many other cities consider themselves living in urban forests in the first place?
Well, there are a lot of them that do. Fortunately, over the last 10 to 15 years, the technology has advanced to the point where we can really accurately measure the extent of our urban forest. And with other cities doing the same thing, we finally have a benchmark to compare ourselves
to. How
do
we do that?
By flying over it with advanced technology and
literally— Are we talking about airplanes or satellites?
It's about airplanes.
Airplanes.
Airplanes. And measuring the extent of ground cover that's actually covered by the trees.
So I've gotten conflicting reports on exactly how much of the city is covered in trees. I've read 46. I've read 47%. What's the figure?
So the two most recent detailed analyses were done in 2010 and then again in 2013.
Okay.
And the technology advanced between those two points of measurement. Mm-hmm. It was 46% at the earlier measurement. It's 47% at the latter measurement. But the reality is that the technological advances mean that there is a plus or minus 1 or 2 percentage points on both of those readings. So in reality, the most recent analyses would indicate that the canopy hasn't really changed all that much. But we have been in a period of lull for real estate development during that time frame. And
I was going to ask, if we go back to 1970 or 1980 or even 1995, before the great boom in subdivision development and things like that, would we have had a much larger tree canopy?
We would have
the same measuring tool.
We would have, but we didn't have the same measuring tool. So it's really like apples and oranges through time to really know exactly how that has changed. Mm-hmm. But the study that was done in 2008 and really the analysis was done in 2010 revealed that we were losing trees at a fairly alarming rate. Between 2003 and 2010, we lost about 5% of the canopy.
Because of development or because of other things?
Well, because of everything. I mean, okay. Aging trees, the canopy is under a lot of stresses. We have major storms that come through. I mean, Hurricane Hugo alone, we lost 88,000 trees during that 24-hour event.
Right.
So the canopy is under stresses, and development is part of it, but not all of it. And as it ages out, of course, we're going to lose more trees.
47% of the city being covered by tree canopy sounds large to me, because we are an urban area, and we have a relatively large downtown that is not covered in tree canopy. How does that compare to other cities who consider themselves to have urban forests?
We compare very favorably. 47% is near the top of the list for cities of our size. And Nashville has a very, very good canopy. But then just to give you a frame of reference, I was recently in Denver. Denver's urban forest consists of 15% canopy. And there are no trees that are indigenous to Denver. So unlike our climate where trees grow here naturally, other communities do not have that benefit. So we're fortunate to be in the climate zone that we're in that's conducive to trees.
Like so many other things, I've heard as compared to Portland, which does have a lot of natural trees. It's just part of the geography in that part of the world. And Denver, as you point out, doesn't have a lot of trees because it's, it's the Southwest and they don't have a lot of trees. And many communities struggle to have 20-30% of the city covered by a tree canopy. But I said at the very beginning that this is not – what's happening here is not by accident, that it was the result of planning. Had that planning – and we'll talk about who did this and why – but had that planning not occurred in the early 1900s, what would we be like today?
Well, there'd be areas that probably remained open. If you look at Myers Park and Eastover and Dilworth, they were cotton fields before they were planted deliberately around the turn of the century. And we'd have many fewer trees than we do today. We certainly wouldn't have the caliper of trees that we have and we enjoy on roads like Queens Road West.
And for 33 years, we had a city arborist, Don McSweeney, who I think had a predecessor. And he retired recently, and they haven't replaced him yet. But that does say something, does it not, about the city's buy-in to the idea that we have to keep a healthy crop of trees going.
We have an incredible tree legacy in Charlotte, both in terms of a cultural commitment to planting trees and caring for them, but also with the city of Charlotte. Don's work is nationally known. We have a terrific street tree program, 185,000 street trees that the city is responsible for. And, we've been a Tree City USA for 35 years here in Charlotte. So we really have a strong legacy. We are known as a city of trees, and people get that here. People like to plant trees, and they understand the importance of trees to the urban environment.
Your organization, Trees Charlotte, came into being in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Did you work with Don and others in the city on tree preservation, or are you a siloed organization?
No, we are the opposite of a siloed organization. Trees Charlotte functions as a collaborative. We are very lean. And we work through partnerships, and one of the most important partnerships we have is with the city of Charlotte. So the city provides us with the technical support and the scientific basis support that we need to do our job correctly.
What exactly is your job? What do you do at Trees Charlotte?
Okay, so Trees Charlotte is a nonprofit organization, and our job is to raise money to buy trees that then we plant with volunteers. So I think of the Trees Charlotte collaboration as a three-legged stool. One leg is Tree Charlotte itself, serving as a nonprofit. We have a board. We raise money with private dollars. We buy the trees, and we coordinate large-scale community plantings across the community. The second leg is the city of Charlotte that, building on its great street tree legacy, provides us with technical support so that everything we do is science-based. And then the third leg, which is really important, is the strong community support and all the energy and the horsepower that we get from the community to put these trees in the ground and ultimately care for them.
Hmm. the fact that we are the City of Trees, as I said, is not by accident. And you mentioned the cotton fields that used to be where Myers Park and other areas, Elizabeth, places like that, are now. So there were no trees. And actually, a lot of people who come to town think that a lot of these new developments in the suburbs that don't have trees are because we tore all the trees down to build the houses. And that is not true either, because it was farmland in many cases. There were not great swaths of trees. So how did we become so protective of trees? How did we decide? Why did we decide that when whoever developed Myers Park and whoever developed Dilworth and whoever developed Elizabeth, what made them want to put trees in? They could have just built houses and been done with it.
Well, fortunately, the planner John Nolan had a view of what Myers Park was to look like, and he engaged a fellow named Earl Draper, who was a landscape architect who loved trees and had an appreciation for them. He really adored the willow oak tree, and willow oaks were found in creek beds around this area, and many of those trees were transplanted and put very deliberately in locations across Charlotte.
And these were big trees that they transplanted.
Well, they were good-sized trees. They had some crazy contraptions to actually move those trees.
I've seen photographs of them doing this, and this is back in the early 1900s when technology was primitive to modern standards. The fact that they could do this and have the trees survive, to me, is amazing.
It is amazing. And, you know, thank goodness that they did it. And there was care along – number one, there was great care in selecting the trees and putting them in the right location. Mm-hmm. And then there's been a great legacy of care along the way to take care of them. And fortunately for us, while we are way over-invested in the willow oak, it is a fabulous urban tree. It's very durable. It's drought-resistant, and it has served us very well.
You mentioned John Nolan, but there's also John and Frederick Law Olmsted, Jr., who were involved in Myers Park. Is that right?
I believe that's right. I don't know the detail on that, Mike.
Their father, Frederick Sr., Frederick Olmsted Sr., is considered to be the father of American landscape architecture, who designed New York Central Park and the grounds and gardens at the Biltmore Estate in Asheville. And in the early 1900s, as we've been talking about, they planted lots of trees to give Myers Park's curving streets the beauty that they have today, because the original city of Charlotte is a grid. That was a new technology, a new way of thinking, I'm told, at the time. It made it easier, and a lot of small towns that you see around North Carolina and South Carolina and Virginia have these winding roads that really don't make any sense because they were all paths. And they thought that putting a grid on downtown would make it easier to navigate and get around and subdivide into lots. Myers Park is the antithesis of that. It is these winding streets around hillsides and these massive oak trees that we see today. How many of the massive oaks that we see in Myers Park today and Elizabeth today are the original trees that were planted?
Many of them. Many of them are, because they were planted in they started in Dilworth in the late 1800s, and then many of them were planted between, let's say, 1895 and 1920 or 1925. And those trees, roughly 100 years old today, are aging out. And that's one of our major challenges as we go forward, is dealing with the loss of trees that we will see in the coming decades.
Wow. If they can plant or transplant almost fully grown trees, why can't we?
We can. It's just very expensive.
Disney World does it. Why can't we? We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to bring another person into this conversation who has intimate knowledge of the people who helped develop Myers Park, because they were also connected in a way to Biltmore Estate. And he's coming to town to show his film as part of the inaugural Charlotte Arbor Week, which is about that Asheville experiment. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Zoo, where polar bears Nikita and Anana take polar plunges every day at the Rocky Coast exhibit. Information at nczoo.org. Are you tired? Depressed? Overweight? Maybe you're not getting enough sleep. The Centers for Disease Control says that at least a third of us aren't sleeping enough. We're not getting the recommended 7+ hours of sleep. Who gets 7 hours of sleep? We're not getting the 7+ hours of sleep that we need on a regular basis, and it's costing us about $35 billion a year. Really? Yep, $35 billion. We find out more about why getting a good night's sleep is important and why it costs so much not to do so tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, EU leaders meet at a summit in Brussels while more than 10,000 migrants are trapped in Greece at closed borders. The ongoing refugee crisis and new questions about the future of Europe.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about saving and increasing Charlotte's tree canopy. We'll find out more about why we need to concentrate on this. We just alluded to the fact that a lot of the trees that are so fabulous that are part of Myers Park and Elizabeth and Dilworth and other in-city neighborhoods are aging out because they were planted in the early 1900s, and they've many of them reached the end of their life cycle. Dave Cable is with us. He's the executive director of Trees Charlotte, founded just 4 years ago as a public-private collaboration to help expand our tree canopy by 250% by 2050. He is in our studio, and joining us now from the studios of WUNC in Durham is Dr. James Lewis, an historian with the Forest History Society and executive producer of the film America's First Forest, Carl Schenck and the Asheville Experiment, a film that will be screened as part of our first Charlotte Arbor Week on March the 15th at Myers Park Baptist Church. Dr. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Well, nice to have you here. Let's go back to something we talked about in the last segment a little bit. I mentioned Frederick Olmsted Sr. He was involved in Biltmore Forest. He was indirectly involved, I suppose, in a way, in Charlotte's development of its trees. But he made a recommendation to George Vanderbilt, who's the fellow who built Biltmore Estate, for someone to care for the forest around Biltmore. That eventually, after a couple of years, led to Carl Schenck, who was from Germany and is the subject of your film. At the time of his hiring at Biltmore, trees were being grown and consumed at a rapid clip in the United States because people thought, and maybe at the time they were right, almost an inexhaustible resource, and they were being grown for commerce, for wood, for supplies. Why did Schenck and others in the Biltmore area, associated with Biltmore Estate, see this as a time for forest management?
Well, you're right in that we were consuming wood at an alarming rate. And in fact, Olmsted, dating back to the 1860s, was already involved in advocating for a different way forward and for planned management. What we weren't doing as a nation and as individual businessmen, you know, timbermen and lumbermen, we were not planning. We were only consuming. And so there was this problem that that they labeled a timber famine. This is Frederick Law Olmsted. This is Charles Sargent at the Arnold Arboretum, who was really the leading botanist in the United States at the time and had written for the U.S. Census in 1890 a multi-volume report on the condition of forests in America. And there were others gathering data, but nobody doing anything actively about it. It was all about, as we've been saying, consumption. And think back to the late 1800s. I mean, as pervasive as wood is today, add to that the fact that most, if not all, households were using wood for fuel. Mm-hmm. There was the charcoal industry. They were logging and consuming chestnuts and other trees for the wood as well as for the bark for tanning leather. So, and then there was the non-timber forest products such as chestnuts and other foods that you could collect in the forest. And that's a lot of pressure being put on forests. We still have a pressure problem today, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But Olmsted and others saw this problem. We mentioned where did you get the statistics for Charlotte and you know the canopy and size. One of the organizations that's been tracking such things is the oldest citizens advocacy group called American Forests, which was established in 1876. And if you check their website, you can get a lot of statistics on Charlotte's urban canopy there. But there are all many parts moving at the same time, but they were a minority voice advocating for forest management, the introduction of science forest, forestry, the science to the United States. Mm-hmm. And it all comes to fruition. It all comes into play at the Biltmore Estate in Western North Carolina. George Vanderbilt, who's the grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt, probably the richest man in America upon his death. And George, his family was so wealthy, he didn't have to work. And he became a collector of great art and literature. And when he visited Asheville in the late 1880s, he just fell in love with the city. And if you've ever been, you could see why. But one of the things he wanted to do was build a small country home there. started out, the plan was 10,000 feet, and it grew tenfold by the time it was finished. It's still America's largest house. Private. Yes. Yeah, it's amazing.
They should do Downton Abbey Part 2 there, it seems to me.
There's a natural connection there that they love. But so Vanderbilt is friends with Frederick Sr., Frederick Olmsted Sr., because right. he had designed for many of the other Vanderbilt family homes. Olmsted's up in years. He's been doing this for some time, but he recommends to George Vanderbilt, don't think locally, act globally, if you will. Mm-hmm. This is the forerunner of that. And he suggests that he should undertake an experiment in Asheville. Try forest management and expand beyond the 5,000 or 6,000 acres you have of exhausted farmland that you've just bought up. And Olmsted looks at the land and he says, this is not going to be the little park setting that you want for deer hunting and the like. You need lots of acres for that. And in fact, Vanderbilt will end up with purchasing about 125,000 acres. But it's Olmsted's vision that Vanderbilt's money can make happen. But then you need somebody to carry that vision forward. And initially, it's Gifford Pinchot. He's the first American-born forester. And he comes in 1892 at the behest of a recommendation, really, of Olmsted, and is there for 3 years and sets up the first large-scale forest management plan in America. Hmm. So what we have is a demonstration forest, an exhibit, and they'll truly exhibit that those accomplishments at the in Chicago at the Great Columbian Exposition of 1893. North Carolina was already a leader in the idea of forest preservation, and in fact, they had a state exhibit there that Gifford Pinchot helped put together. And so they demonstrated two things: one was what is a forest. They had an actual exhibit. And then the other was Pinchot wrote this little booklet called Biltmore Forest, in which he talked about what forest management is. And this is what we're doing at the Biltmore Estate. And you can still find them on eBay. It's a really neat little booklet, complete with photos and everything, that explains everything that we're talking about today. Or not everything, not urban forestry, of course. But it just lays it all out there. And so Pinchot's reputation begins to grow, and he becomes a national figure, and he's also a young man in a hurry. Gifford Pinchot is the son of a wealthy New York businessman. He doesn't have to work for a living. He's not dependent on his salary. And his father had already charged him with nothing short of change America, become a forester, and help change our attitudes, help bring forestry to America. He starts at Biltmore. He'll move on and become the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And there's a great connection that I'm sure Dave can talk about.
Let's cut to Carl Schenck, because we can't spend the whole talk. That's okay. We just can't spend the whole time talking about Pinchot, because Schenck is the subject of this film that's being screened. And he was brought in from Germany. And I'm just curious as to why, because in Germany at the time, they had a habit of, in terms of forest management, they had a habit of planting the same trees over and over again. They would let them grow. They would harvest them. They would plant the same trees. And over time, in a relatively short amount of time actually, the soil would no longer support those trees because it would exhaust the nutrients in the soil. And that's the kind of thing that he kind of brought to the fore here, didn't he? Why would we bring somebody like that into this? Or did we not know that was going on in Germany at the time?
They didn't know that yet.
Okay.
But why? Because Gifford Pinchot was the only forester working in America.
Okay.
The only other forester was working in Washington. Bernard Furneaux worked – he was the chief of the Division of Forestry in the federal government, and he didn't even have a forest to manage. The national forests, such as they were called forest reserves, were actually housed in the Department of the Interior, and Furneaux was in the Department of Agriculture. So he had nothing to manage. So Pinchot reached out to his mentor back in Germany and asked for a recommendation. And, well, you need an English-speaking forester for starters, and Carl Schenck could do that. He had learned to speak English. He had learned the language by memorizing Shakespeare's King Richard II to impress an English girl he wanted to date while in college.
So the idea of bringing a Carl Schenck or a Pinchot into Biltmore, because it had he brought up Vanderbilt bought 125,000 acres, and it was wooded, correct? Most of it was wooded acreage, but he wanted to not only harvest some of that, he also wanted to set up game and fishing and hunting and camping and opportunities for himself and his guests and his friends and things like that. 120,000 acres sounds enormous, but in the scheme of things, in the mountains of North Carolina, it's probably not all that much. How much management does something like that require, and what kind of management are we talking about?
It requires – at the time, it required intensive management because the area surrounding the house, the Biltmore House, was exhausted farmland, and so that needed to be rehabilitated. There was very little tree cover there. And don't forget the house is sitting up on hills, so it's they had to just plant trees around the house to get that process started. A lot of the majority of the land that Vanderbilt was buying up that would become Pisgah Forest and eventually Pisgah National Forest was a mix of uncut land as well as occupied land by locals, some doing farming, some doing moonshining, which creates problems for Carl Schenck in terms of management. One way to hide the fact that you have an illegal still is to set a fire. And so Schenck is on record as complaining about these fire bugs. It angered him greatly, as you can imagine, because he's looking at the forest as, a standing tree is he sees dollar signs
right.
for the most part. But he's charged by Vanderbilt and Olmsted with managing the land not just for timber but also, as you said, for recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. And it's really a unique situation because Schenck is working for a single person, George Vanderbilt, whereas today our national forest supervisors and land managers work for us, meaning the citizenry. But we have the same goals. We want recreation, but we also want wood products. Schenck has to balance these, but he also has to balance the books. He's got to make this pay somehow. And that's what our film talks about is some of these challenges he faces, some of the management goals, how you get there. Everyone wants pretty much the same thing, but how you get there is where foresters in that era and somewhat today differed, and he and Gifford Pinchot will clash over that.
And he's a visionary because he doesn't stay there very long. He's there 1895 to 1913, but his work on the school on he started the Biltmore Forest School, which branched out into his being able to teach similar programs, and it also caused American universities around the country to start their own forestry programs. I'm just curious what a place like Charlotte, how it compares to what – the management of a forest like 125,000 acres at Biltmore, how does that compare to what a Charlotte has to do to maintain their tree canopy?
You know, it's really interesting the parallels between – when I watched that movie, the parallels between what Schenck faced and what he learned and what issues exist in Charlotte. I will tell you, for Charlotte, number one, everything has to be science-based. And certainly Schenck was very dedicated to the science of silviculture and forestry. That is an important foundation for the work of Tree Charlotte. Number two is ultimately it led to a public-private partnership through Pisgah Forest and the opening up of that resource for the community.
The Vanderbilt Forest is now the Pisgah National Forest.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so we've got those partnerships going here in Charlotte. It isn't just a private sector problem. It isn't just a public sector problem. It's really for natural resources, specifically the urban forest, as was the case in Asheville, it requires this arm-in-arm working together across public-private lines.
And would it be accurate to say, Dr. Lewis, that Carl Schenck came up with a lot of the principles upon the scientific principles that we depend on today, not only here in Charlotte, but in forestry and forest preservation elsewhere?
I wouldn't say he came up with them, but he certainly introduced them. He brought them over from Germany. The Germans had been developing the science of forestry since the early 1700s. So he had a lot of information, and he had to adapt that information because, as you mentioned earlier, in Germany they were growing trees as crops. And so if you think of a tree plantation here in the United States, row after row after row of trees, that's what they were doing in Germany, because when they were faced with a timber shortage, they studied and recognized the problem and began this process. Eventually, they would have to move away from it, as you said, because of the exhaustion of the soil and things like that. But when he comes to the United States, he's face-to-face with what he called a chaos of trees, and it's the wilderness that we envision today. But he was trying to introduce a more organized, systematic approach to growing and then harvesting timber. Ultimately, he's a businessman, and he's got to make this pay for Vanderbilt. And that was Vanderbilt and Olmsted's vision, was demonstrate this for America. Mm. We're not replanting, and sometime in our lifetimes, they predicted, I think, by the 1920s, so, you know, one generation away, they thought we were going to be out of timber.
Wow.
That is one of the great legacies of Carl Schenck, is demonstrating with some success, with some failures, though, that we could do it a different way and have timber. You know, you can have a healthy environment and a healthy economy at the same time.
And that balance is so true, important here in Charlotte. And the lessons of replenishment. I mean, it's a natural resource that has to be actively and proactively managed, and we have to be committed to constant replenishment.
I want to talk about that when we come back from the break, because that's what you're doing, what you're trying to do, not only replenishment, but increasing the canopy size in Charlotte going forward, which is a challenge for many, many reasons, not the least of which we're the fastest growing city in the country. And given that, it's hard to keep the trees that we have, much less expand. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, hosting a bridal jewelry trunk show featuring parade designs, White House brothers, and many more. Thursday through Saturday at Moorcroft Village South Park. Details at DonaldHack.com. On the Diane Rehm Show today, European leaders meet at a summit in Brussels while more than 10,000 migrants are trapped in Greece at closed borders, the ongoing refugee crisis, and new questions about the future of Europe, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes. On Monday, March 14th, Monday, we'll be doing a live special program on Charlotte Talks from the McGlohan Theater at Spirit Square in advance of the next day's North Carolina primary. We'd like you to be in the audience. Maybe you get a chance to ask your own questions. Well, you can do that by going to our website and RSVPing and finding details at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Robert Stickler, president and CEO of the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, a WFAE underwriter.
I think that businesses that aren't looking at WFAE are missing the opportunity to reach an upscale, intelligent audience. And if you've got the kind of product that would appeal to those folks, this is one of the very focused ways that you can reach them.
Find out more. Email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's tree canopy in advance of the inaugural Charlotte Arbor Week, which starts March 12th. And on March the 15th, America's First Forest, the film by Dr. Jamie Lewis, our guest at WUNC this morning, will be screening at Myers Park Baptist at 6:30. Dave Cable is also with us in our studio. He's executive director of Trees Charlotte. I'm going to go back up here about our tree canopy in Charlotte. The Observer said in an article they wrote in January that the century-old green canopy that graces Charlotte's oldest neighborhoods is tottering. That's a dangerous word when you're talking about trees. And they're talking about trees in Myers Park and Dilworth, Elizabeth, Belmont, and Chantilly. Many of the trees, as you've already said, Dave, in those areas are the original – this is hard to believe for a lot of people. They are the original trees that were planted there in the early 1900s. These trees have seen – generations of people come and go, and yet they remain. They've seen houses come and go, and yet they remain. How long do – and many of them are – most of them, I think, are oaks, aren't they? Most of them?
Many of them are.
How long does a tree like an oak tree, a willow oak, live? What's its lifespan?
Well, it depends so much on the specific environment that it's operating in and how many stresses it's under.
Well, is it difficult to be a tree lining Queens Road? I'm
it
serious.
Is.
It's why?
It is.
Why
it
is it difficult?
Well, it's confined. Air quality is not great.
But the trees clean the air. That's their job.
They do. They do. And the willow oak does that quite well, particularly particulate matter, which is an important thing. But the trees are under stress. And in Charlotte last summer, you probably remember, we had a period of drought, which is not all that atypical for this territory. We have the cankerworm, which is kind of a constant stress on the trees. And as they age out, these stresses become more cumulative. And when we get a big storm, particularly when it's a leaf-on storm, we can have a lot of tree loss. Hmm. And so it's just these stresses that are inherent in the urban environment on top of the age of these trees that's really going to be the problem going forward.
Are they dangerous?
Definitely. I mean, trees can become liabilities. They're difficult sometimes to assess how dangerous they actually are. And I want to just give a shout-out to the city of Charlotte for the great job that they do. And can you imagine the management responsibility of 185,000 trees?
Wow.
And they do an excellent job of trying to be proactive and removing trees that are threats to people.
Those neighborhoods that I just mentioned, according to the Observer at least, at Myers Park, Dilworth, Elizabeth, Belmont, and Chantilly have 35,000 trees in those neighborhoods. 56% of those trees, of those 35,000 trees, 56% are rated in fair condition, with 4% in poor condition or dead, found to be dead. That leaves only 40% of the tree canopy, if I've done the math right, as being healthy. How do you handle that and plan for the replenishment of the canopy? How do you handle making sure these trees remain upright until you take them down while you're managing planting new trees to replace the ones you are going to take down?
Right. So you have to think of trees in two basic categories. One is a street tree that's in the public domain, and then there are trees that are in the private domain.
In your backyard.
In the backyard. And mm-hmm. the street trees typically, you know, lie between the curb and the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. Those are in the city's domain, and the city is very focused on identifying those trees. They've inventoried about 150,000 of the 185,000 in the city. And they are tracking the health of those trees and trying to stay ahead of issues that come up as they age out.
The healthiest of the older trees were found south of Uptown, I'm told, in Dilworth and parts of Myers Park, while the trees east of the city in places like Elizabeth, Belmont, and Chantilly are not as healthy. Do we understand why?
I don't know the answer to that, Mike. That's a great question, and I'm sure one of the arborists with the city could help with that, but I'm really not familiar with
and you
why.
You mentioned the willow oak, which has become kind of Charlotte's signature tree, but you say that we're way over-invested in willow oaks. Tell me why.
Well, I kind of think of the portfolio of trees we have in Charlotte as an investment portfolio. There's an analogy there.
Mm-hmm.
And
put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The diversification of the urban forest is a very, very important aspect of management. And in Charlotte, the willow oaks, the crepe myrtles, and the red maples make up about 40% of the street tree inventory. That is way too heavy in those three species. Yeah. So one of the things—
And that was by design early on?
I think it's a result of the planting activities that happened around the turn of the century. But so part of Tree Charlotte is responsibility and focus is to really diversify the canopy as we plant. So this year we're going to be planting between 5,000 and 6,000 7-gallon containerized trees across the city, 50 different varieties of those trees. The idea being that if we can plant consistently 5,000 to 10,000 trees every year of a variety, 10, 20, 30 years from now, we will end up with a much more resilient urban forest.
Dr. Lewis, according to a tree inventory taken by American Forests, Charlotte has 215 species of trees. The willow oaks and crepe myrtles are the other species, maples, I guess, are the ones found most often. If we're over-invested in willow oaks, that means we're under-invested in other trees. So how important would you say diversity is in an urban forest? And given the age of our trees, how do you bring in that diversity? Stop planting willow oaks?
Don't stop planting those, but as Dave was saying, plant others. A couple of examples from history, and then both past and recent. Turn of the beginning of the 20th century, the American elm was the city tree, and they were being planted. It was basically monoculture forestry, a single species, and then a blight came through and obliterated them.
Mm-hmm.
They replaced them with another, by and large, single species, the ash, which is now being decimated, and it's working its way throughout the United States. Wherever ash is, the emerald ash borer is this little tiny, shiny green insect. It's very pretty but very deadly. It's just wreaking havoc with the entire ash species. It's here in North Carolina. It's all around us in the surrounding states. That's going to be a problem because we had done a planted heavily there. In my neighborhood, which is about 15 years old, when the developer came in, they planted Bradford pear trees, and that's all they planted. And about 5 years ago, a blight came through and just took out all the trees. Again, the problem of monoculture, it leaves you vulnerable.
Is that why we have a problem with canker worms in Charlotte? Because they like willow oaks, and we have so many willow oaks that they've all moved to Charlotte and they call it home now.
Well, I think that's part of the equation because they do like the willow oak.
So if we had more diversity in the urban forest that is Charlotte, we'd have less of a canker worm problem and less of a tree problem because they're harming the oaks. They're harming the trees.
They actually infest more than just the oaks. They happen to particularly like the oak tree.
Okay.
But if we were more diverse, I have to think that the impact on that particular insect would be less. But the key issue is that we don't know what's around the corner. And so having a diverse portfolio of trees is important to be resistant and resilient simply because there are so many unknown pests and diseases that we have yet to even determine.
Many people have been chiming in on Facebook and Twitter and email while we've been talking, so let me share some of their comments. Ben says, love our canopy, but who brought the sweet gum to Charlotte? We on the east side spend days picking them up every spring, one by one, because they're like tiny Velcro balls in the grass. Mike in Charlotte writes, I live off Sardis Road, near Sardis Road North. Why are sweet gum trees so pervasive? Do they have no commercial value? Also, speak about West Virginia being raped of its hardwood trees with little regard for the future of the forest. You haven't mentioned sweet gum trees as being a part of the tree canopy in Charlotte. How many do we have? Obviously a lot.
We have a lot, and I'm happy to say we do not plant sweet gums through Tree Charlotte.
Okay.
The black gum tree is a great tree, and the sweet gum has done very well in the urban environment.
Dr.
Sounds
Lou?
Like some people feel that one sweet gum tree is one too many.
let me see. Catherine in Concord, I see developers during site preparation removing soil and leaving rocky dirt. Although people plant trees, they are stunted and damaged by drought. How do we prevent this? Those are two separate topics in the same question. In drought, should we plant a tree in the drought or should we wait for the drought to end?
Well, it's important to plant a tree during the right time of year, which around here is October to roughly the 1st of April. And then it is very important to keep the tree watered, particularly in its first several years of growth. And once it becomes established, a drought-resistant tree will do well through time. But in those early stages of development, watering the tree is very, very important. Mm.
Mary writes, Dave Cable and the Tree Charlotte organization have been so successful in connecting the Charlotte public to improving our tree canopy, bringing groups together to plant trees and establishing personal connections with the trees. That sounds interesting. Will help the continued sustainability of our urban forest. My husband and I have loved volunteering with Tree Charlotte. A couple of years ago, I planted trees with West Charlotte High School students. After planting each tree, the students would name it. At the end of the day, students talked about coming back to visit their trees, Shrek, Sylvester, and Mabel Maple, for years to come.
Well, you know, that is it's an interesting point. I wanted to say two things on that, Mike. Number one, when a student, particularly a child, plants a tree at their school, something magical happens. And as I have told them, and I really do believe this, they will never forget that day, and they're going to go away and be successful. And when they come back to Charlotte, they're going to want to see that tree and how it's done. It provides them with a really interesting lesson around stewarding the earth, but also a connection to that place. The second thing I wanted to make a point of, and this is going back to the film, one of the lessons that I got out of Carl Shank's work is the importance of community engagement. I mean, he created a forest festival. He worked with the mountain people early on in his work in the estate, and he did a great job of bringing the community along. And that is really one of the most important things of urban forestry, too, is community engagement, bringing people in, giving them an opportunity to engage. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, this is not a government problem. It's not a nonprofit's problem. It's really the community's resource to manage altogether.
And Dr. Lewis, I understand that Carl Shank, when he took over the job at Biltmore, was very successful in enlisting, or maybe they wanted to – I got the impression that he didn't enlist, that the people of the area, young men, came to him and wanted to be part of this and became Shank's boys, essentially, who they managed the forest for him. They did all the heavy lifting, so to speak. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah. A few college graduates had gotten word of this experiment going on over at the Biltmore Estate. And one of the first ones to literally come over the mountain was Overton Price, a college graduate, a local boy, who eventually went on to be Associate Chief of the U.S. Forest Service under Gifford Pinchot. But they first were showing up and asking, hey, can I just work with you and learn? And after a few years, you know, they were asking all these questions, and Shank realized, well, if I formalize this, I could actually make this a revenue stream. Mm-hmm. And so he opened the Biltmore Forest School in 1898, and it operated very successfully for 15 years. And in fact, when he had to close it in 1913 because of competition from professional forestry schools granting college degrees. But when he closed it in 1913, 70% of all foresters working in the United States were Biltmore Forest School graduates.
That's really amazing.
And then when they established the Pisgah National Forest in 1916, who did they hire to be the first forest supervisor? But Vern Rhodes, a graduate of the Biltmore Forest School.
Here in Charlotte, the city plants trees. We have tree ordinances in place to protect the trees that we have, and they insist when developers come in and have to take a tree down, they have to replace it with a new tree, because sometimes you do have to take a tree down to build a building. Your organization, Tree Charlotte, plants trees. You're also developing a master plan. Did we not have a master plan? Did the city not have a master plan before Tree Charlotte came along?
Well, it's an effort that involves both Tree Charlotte and the city. The pillars of managing the forest include a strong regulatory framework. That's one piece of it. Number two is we've got to have a really good street tree program, which we do in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And then the third leg of that initiative is to have an active community engagement and volunteer planting initiative, which is what Tree Charlotte is. What's underway now is to create an urban forestry management plan, which is essentially what I refer to as a playbook that will allow and maximize the efforts of all three of those pillars so that they're working together to manage the forest.
Now, your goal is to increase the tree canopy to 50% by 2050. We're at 47% today, and people may think, well, that doesn't sound too hard. But you're talking about 15,000 trees a year being planted in addition to the 10,000 that the city plants. That's 25, is it 25? No, it's 200, it's a half a million trees. It's 250,000 trees we're talking about planting. Where do these trees come from? Are these little saplings? Are they medium-sized trees? Are they fully grown trees like the ones they put in Myers Park originally? Where do they come from?
So we buy our trees from four different growers. And they're the best in North Carolina. They're all North Carolina-based. They're scattered around the state to eliminate hurricane risk so we don't lose our inventory. And our mission is to plant 500,000 trees, actually, over the next coming decades. What people don't realize is that while 47 to 50% sounds fairly benign, each percentage point is about 100,000 trees. And so as you look at the canopy and we look at the aging canopy and the development that's going on, that 47% is going to be under pressure to move down. And so in reality, I think we really need to aim at 500,000 trees.
Who pays for all this?
Private donors. So we are raising money to buy the trees and we engage the community to put them in the ground.
We have 30 seconds here. So you have a whole bunch of activities scheduled for the inaugural Arbor Week. We don't have time to mention them now, and I'm very sorry for that. Is there a place people can find out about
them? Yeah, treecharlotte.org. They're all listed. Okay. They start with a huge planting event on the 12th and then a citywide tree store on the 19th where people, Charlotte residents, can come get free trees.
And Dr. Jamie Lewis's film, America's First Forest, Carl Schenck and the Ash Experience will be screened at Myers Park Baptist on the 15th of March at 6:30. It will be screened along with Keeping Watch, presented by the Charlotte chapter of the North Carolina Wildfire Association. Good luck with your efforts on the trees.
Thank you, Mike,
Love
for having
tree.
Us.
Thank you both for being here. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.